From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Last November, 15 Iraqis in the town of Haditha were killed by U.S. Marines. This week, Time magazine investigates whether their deaths were the result of accident or an act of revenge.
The U.S. military is conducting a criminal investigation into allegations U.S. Marines shot and killed 15 civilians after an American Marine was killed by a roadside bomb. A videotape obtained by Time magazine shows many of the victims were still in their night clothes when they died. Seven of them were women. There were three children. We'll speak with the reporter who broke the story, then former top Republican strategist Kevin Phillips.
American theocracy is really about three major converging forces that pose a problem for the United States: radical religion, oil, and debt. And they have a lot in common, they interact, and it's a real threat to the United States.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This news from the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. A FBI agent testified Tuesday the government ignored warnings that could possibly have prevented the 9/11 attacks. Greg Samit, who arrested Moussaoui in August 2001, said he spent 4 weeks trying to convince his superiors Moussaoui posed a security risk. According to Samit, the warnings were made at least 70 times, and FBI officials were even told of a specific threat of a plane attack on the World Trade Center. But Samit said his efforts were stonewalled. Samit blamed his superiors, quote, obstructionism, criminal negligence, and careerism for blocking a serious opportunity to stop the 9/11 attacks. In the latest violence from Iraq, 17 police officers were killed today when gunmen stormed a prison north of Baghdad. Almost three dozen prisoners were freed in the attack. The prison was left in flames. The assaults came one day after at least 39 people were killed in violence around the country. As poll numbers continue to show decreasing public support for his presidency in the war in Iraq, President Bush appealed Monday for more patience. Speaking in Cleveland, Ohio, he said he could understand people being disheartened, but implored Americans to see signs of progress. During the question period, the president was asked about the pre-war claim Saddam Hussein was linked to the 9/11 attacks.
First, just if I might correct a misperception, I don't think we ever said, at least I know I didn't say, that there was a direct connection between September the 11th and Saddam Hussein.
Critics immediately lashed out at the president's remarks. In a letter to Congress delivered 3 years ago today, the president wrote, quote, "The use of armed forces against Iraq is consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th, 2001. In France, unions and student groups have called a general strike for next week against a new employment law that'll make it easier for companies to fire young workers. Over 500,000 people filled the streets across France this weekend in protest. According to a new poll, 68% of French citizens are opposed to the measure. The government has stood firm on the first job contract law, which allows employers to fire workers under the age of 26 for any reason during a 2-year trial period. Meanwhile, a demonstrator is in a coma after sustaining critical injuries at a Paris demonstration Saturday. According to his union, the man, Cyril Ferez, was beaten viciously by police. A photo taken of the incident shows Ferez lying on the ground before he is swarmed by police. Witnesses accuse police of refusing to call the paramedics after they beat him. In the occupied territories, Israel has reopened a border crossing to the Gaza Strip following heightened warnings of a massive food crisis. Israel had shut down the Karni crossing for most of the last 3 months, citing security reasons. The closure led to a shortage of wheat, dairy, and other humanitarian goods in Gaza, home to over 1.5 million Palestinians. In Serbia, tens of thousands of people turned out in Belgrade this weekend to honor Slobodan Milosevic a week after he died in his prison cell at The Hague. Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who supported Milosevic during his war crimes tribunal, was there.
Slobodan Milosevic was dragged in chains from his homeland to The Hague to face criminal charges while the U.S. and NATO continue their criminal wars with impunity. Can all the violence of Yugoslavia, including its valiant resistance in World War II, compare with George Bush's war of aggression against Iraq?
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. At least 2,000 people gathered for a counter-demonstration in Belgrade Saturday. Meanwhile, the dispute over the circumstances of Milosevic's death continues. Attorneys acting on behalf of his family are requesting access to medical files on his condition in the months before he died. The request comes after The Hague announced a new autopsy found Milosevic did not die of poisoning, as his supporters have claimed. In Belarus, the president, Alexander Lukashenko, is facing a challenge at home and abroad amid allegations his government committed massive fraud to win Sunday's election. Lukashenko was reelected with 82% of the vote. Over 15,000 people have demonstrated in the capital in the last 2 days to contest those results. Thus far, Russia is the only major foreign country to accept the vote. Back in the United States, anti-war protests continue to mark the third anniversary of the invasion. In Washington, hundreds of people marched on the Pentagon carrying a mock coffin they intended to give to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The demonstrators were met with a steel barrier erected by police to bar their entry. About 30 people were arrested when they managed to cross the fence. Among them, Michael Berg, whose son, Nicholas Berg, was beheaded by Iraqi kidnappers in 2004. Before his arrest, Michael Berg said these words.
My son was killed out of revenge for the atrocities Americans committed at the Abu Ghraib prison, murdering, raping, and torturing. So for me to say, look how horrible what they did to my son, certainly I'm entitled to revenge. Well, those people can say the same thing, because there are people over there in Iraq who lost their sons and daughters in that prison. And there are 100,000 people in Iraq dead. And think of all the families there that think that they're entitled to revenge. I don't think revenge is justified under any circumstances. Revenge is an endless cycle, and it has to stop somewhere, and it stops with me.
Michael Berg lost his son, Nick Berg, in Iraq. Meanwhile, 17 anti-war demonstrators were arrested during a rush hour protest Monday in San Francisco's financial district to remember the third anniversary of the U.S. invasion and to call for an end to U.S.-sponsored torture. The University of California has voted to divest from several countries doing business in Sudan, companies doing business in Sudan over the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Darfur. The vote marked the second divestment vote in UC's history after it cut ties to companies linked to South African apartheid in 1986. The measure will affect the UC's dealings with nine companies. In other news, another worker involved in the response to 9/11 has died. Deborah Reeve, who worked for months at a morgue following the attacks on the World Trade Center, died last week of lung cancer. Doctors blamed her death on exposure to toxic dust from the World Trade Center site. A pending lawsuit claims at least 20 people have died from ground zero exposure. And in New Orleans, 10 people barricaded themselves inside one of the country's oldest Black Roman Catholic churches Monday to protest its planned closure. Freed slaves founded the St. Augustine Church in 1841. The New Orleans Archdiocese plans to close it down as a cost-saving measure. We reach Cynthia Doliol, who is among 10 people inside the church.
And we're just trying to get answers as to why they would close the oldest Black church in the United States. Everyone in New Orleans has lost everything else. Now they are trying to make us lose our church, and we're very disappointed and hoping someone will hear us and we'll get better answers than what we've gotten so far.
Cynthia Doliol inside St. Augustine Church in New Orleans protesting its closure. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military is conducting a criminal investigation into allegations Marines shot and killed 15 civilians, including 7 women and 3 children, 4 months ago in Iraq. The killings occurred early on the morning of November 19th, after a roadside bomb struck a Humvee carrying U.S. Marines in the western Iraqi town of Haditha. The bomb killed one Marine, injured 2 others. The next day, the Marines said in a statement that 15 Iraqi civilians died in the initial blast. They said that after the explosion, gunmen attacked the U.S. convoy with small arms fire, prompting the Marines to return fire, killing 8 insurgents. But relatives, survivors, and doctors who saw the bodies say that's not true. They say the 15 men, women, and children were killed when Marines burst into their houses after the blast and shot them dead in their nightclothes. Human rights activists said if the accusations proved to be true, the attack would rank as the worst case of deliberate killing of Iraqi civilians by U.S. service members since the war began. Soon after the attack, the mayor of Haditha led an angry delegation up to a nearby Marine camp to seek redress. Their protests were ignored, and the U.S. military stood by its original contention that the civilians were killed by a roadside bomb. The story would have ended there had it not been taken up by Time magazine. Time obtained a videotape shot in Haditha by an Iraqi journalism student one day after the incident. The tape shows many of the victims, especially the women and children, were still in their nightclothes when they died. The scenes from inside the houses show that the walls and ceilings are pockmarked with shrapnel, bullet holes, and blood. In January, Time presented a copy of the video along with witness testimony to U.S. military command in Baghdad. A preliminary military investigation was launched. It established the men, women, and children were indeed killed by the Marines, though it described the deaths as, quote, collateral damage. Now the case has been referred for criminal investigation by the Navy to establish whether the 12 Marines involved were guilty of misconduct. We're joined right now by one of the reporters for Time magazine who broke this story. Aparashim Ghosh is the chief international correspondent for Time magazine. He spent the last 3.5 years in Iraq and joins us today in our Firehouse studio. Oh, we called the Pentagon, invited them on the program, but the Pentagon spokesperson, Lieutenant Colonel Barry Venable, declined to join us, saying it would be, quote, inappropriate to comment while an investigation is underway. Aparashim Ghosh, we thank you for joining us.
Hi, Amy.
Tell us the story. Your story in Time is called One Morning in Haditha.
Haditha is a small town northwest of Baghdad, a very, very dangerous place. It's in the heart of what's known as the Sunni Triangle. And Marines and soldiers who operate in that area are under constant threat. On the morning of the 19th of November, a 4 Humvee patrol going through town was hit by an IED, an improvised explosive device, which sheared off the front of one of the Humvees, killed one of the soldiers inside. What happens next is a matter of some debate. As you pointed out, initially the Marines claimed that a total of 23 people were killed on the spot, 15 of them innocent civilians, all of whom the Marines said were killed by the IED, and 8 of them enemy combatants who were shot by the Marines and killed.
In addition to the 15.
We looked into this case, and the more we dug, the more we thought that something didn't quite add up. And when we finally got our hands on this videotape, it became very clear to us that these people could not have been killed outdoors by an explosive device. They were killed in their homes, in their nightclothes. The nightclothes are significant because Iraqi women and children especially are very, very unlikely to go outdoors wearing their nightclothes. It is a very conservative society. When we first approached the Marines with this evidence, they responded in quite a hostile fashion. They accused us of buying into enemy propaganda. That aroused our suspicions even further because it seemed to be excessively hostile on their part. And we dug even more. We spoke to witnesses. We spoke to survivors of this incident. And then we became quite convinced that these people were killed by the Marines. What is left to be seen is whether they were killed in the course of the Marine operation as collateral damage or by accident, or whether the Marines went on a rampage after one of their own had been killed and killed these people in revenge.
You're very graphic in the piece, One Morning in Haditha. Describe what the survivors say happened when the U.S. military went into the nearby houses around where the roadside bomb had exploded.
Well, the survivors claim, let me back up a little bit. The Marines claim that they received small arms fire from nearby homes and that they responded to this fire, they shot back, and then they went into the homes to try and flush out the bad guys, the terrorists who were in there. It's clear from the video that those homes don't have any bullet marks outside, which would suggest that there was very little, if any, shooting by the Marines at the facades of these homes. But there are lots of signs of bullets inside. The victims told us that the Marines came in and they killed everybody in sight. In one house, they threw a grenade into a kitchen. That set off a propane tank and nearly destroyed the kitchen and killed several people in that home. The scenes that were described by the survivors and the witnesses were incredibly bloody and very graphic, but they're unfortunately very commonplace in Iraq.
Inside, you have the description of a 9-year-old girl.
Yes.
Tell us about her and her family and what she says happened.
Well, she was indoors with her family when the explosion took place. The explosion was loud enough to wake everybody up in the neighborhood.
The bomb that killed the Marine.
The first explosion, yes. And she says when she heard gunshots, of course, she's a child, she was frightened. When the Marines stormed towards their home, her grandfather slipped into the next room as his... apparently was his custom to pray, to reach out for the family Quran and pray to God that this crisis would pass. On this occasion, the Marines came into the home. They entered the room where the grandfather was and other members of the family and killed him.
And she was left alive?
She survived, yes.
And her little brother?
And her brother was injured by a piece of, either by a bullet or a piece of shrapnel, we're not sure.
But her parents, her mother, her father, her grandparents?
Her grandparents, I believe her uncle, were also killed.
And then another house?
4 houses in all, involving a total of, indoors, total of 19 people and 4 people outside.
And what, once you had more details like this, did the military respond outside of saying that you were just buying the enemy propaganda?
Well, once we had all these details and we were not getting any way with the Marines, we took the videotape and the evidence that we had to the senior most military public affairs officer in Baghdad and showed him what we had. He then took that evidence and passed it on to his superior officers, recommending that they conduct a full and thorough inquiry. That inquiry is a 2-step process. The first step has been completed.
And then this Haditha journalism student. Who is this student?
We'd rather not say for his own protection, but he was a young local man. It's not uncommon in Iraq for young people to have video cameras and cameras, and there's so much going on in their lives that they have plenty to shoot.
And you got a hold of this, or Hammurabi Human Rights got a hold of this?
He brought the tape to Hammurabi Human Rights, which is a local human rights group, and they brought it to us once they found out that we were inquiring about this.
There have been many allegations from Iraqis that similar behavior by U.S. troops has caused numerous civilian deaths during the occupation, especially during the offensive in Fallujah and elsewhere. Just this week, it was reported that Iraqi police have accused U.S. soldiers of executing 11 Iraqi civilians, including 4 children and a 6-month-old baby in a raid last Wednesday near the city of Balad.
Yes.
Were you in Baghdad at the time that this started to come
out? I was in Baghdad, and I saw the reports when they came out. We were unable to get to Balad. It's very unsafe there, and we were unable to get there to confirm the story. But as you point out, this kind of story is very commonplace. At our bureau in Baghdad, we receive complaints like this all the time. They're very hard to verify. This was a very rare instance where we were able to speak to witnesses where there was videotape available. In most cases, none of these materials are available to us. And let's face it, it's very difficult in a situation like that to establish the truth.
And so now, Operation Ghosh, in February, after you presented the videotape to the military, you write that an infantry colonel went to Haditha for a week-long probe in which he interviewed Marines, survivors, and doctors at the morgue. The probe concluded civilians were, in fact, killed by Marines, not by an insurgent bomb, and that no insurgents appeared to be in the first 2 houses raided by the Marines. The probe found, however, that the deaths were the result of collateral damage rather than malicious intent by Marines.
Yes, the first inquiry was meant to look into the facts, what exactly happened. And it concluded that the soldiers shot back at what they perceived to be as enemy fighters from these homes, and then entered the homes, and these people were killed in the process. The second inquiry, which is about to get underway and is being conducted by the NCIS, is to look into the motivation. The Naval Criminal Investigation Service. So this is a criminal investigation. Their job will be to establish the motives of the Marines, to find out whether the Marines acted properly and within the rules of engagement, whether their actions were motivated by a genuine threat or genuine perception of a threat, or whether they were reacting to one of their own being killed.
You interviewed the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Khalilzad?
That's right, I did, but not on this subject.
What did you talk to him about?
Well, I talked to him about what the U.S. was able to do in this political crisis that's in Iraq. There is a complete stalemate. The different political groups have each painted themselves into a different corner of the room. They seem unable to get together and form the unity government that is what the United States most desperately wants. And we talked to him about his efforts in that connection, and we talked to him about what leverage he was able to bring to bear with these leaders.
I just wanted to end by asking on the resolution of this story, which, as you say, is not isolated, although this is a very you have a great deal of detail on Haditha. You weren't able to go to Haditha?
No, we were not.
Because?
Because it's in the heart of the Sunni Triangle. The only way we could get there would be to embed with the Marines themselves, and that didn't feel right to us. If we were investigating them, it seemed to be a bad idea to be traveling with them and under their protection.
And so you spoke to the children, the survivors.
We were able to get the witnesses to come to us in Baghdad. The human rights group came to us in Baghdad, and of course we saw the videotape, which was from the scene, and we heard from other local people like the mayor and the doctor and other functionaries.
You say the U.S. has paid relatives of the victims $2,500 for each of the 15 dead civilians, plus smaller payments for the injured?
Yes. That is commonplace in cases of innocents being killed in combat.
You end in a very touching way the piece that you wrote along with your colleague who has just left Baghdad also.
Yes.
Tim McCloy. Nothing can bring back all that was taken from 9-year-old Iman Walid on that fateful day last November. She still does not comprehend how, when her father went in to pray with the Quran for the family's safety, his prayers were not answered, as they had been so many times in the past. He always prayed before, and the Americans left us alone, she says. Leaving, she grabs a handful of candy. It's for my little brother, she says. Her brother, very terrorized, very traumatized.
As are thousands of young people in Iraq today, but this family in particular, she's now an orphan. There is an extended family that will look after her, but she will never... any hope of a normal life for her now over.
Well, we'll certainly continue to follow this case. Based on your being in Iraq for a number of years now, what do you think will happen? Do you think this is different because of the videotape?
Yes, I think the military is taking it seriously now, finally. I think the NCIS report will probably take a few weeks to come through. If the Marines are found guilty of wrongdoing, I hope that the military makes an example of them, as they did with those found guilty with Abu Ghraib. It is important for the Iraqis to know that, unlike the terrorists who will very happily kill innocents and then boast about it, that when it happens with American soldiers, that the people are held responsible and punished for it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Aparashim Ghosh.
Thanks, Amy.
He wrote the piece with Tim McGurk, One Morning in Haditha. U.S. Marines killed 15 Iraqi civilians in their homes last November. Was it self-defense, an accident, or cold-blooded revenge? The piece appears in this week's Time magazine. Thank you. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Kevin Phillips on American Theocracy.
Aman, 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 dad, dad, bidad, jasadun ashbahu shayin, jasadun ashbahu shayin,
بالخيال وفؤادي عن هواكم غير سالي وفؤادي عن هواكم غير سالي وعيون 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 نثرت أدمعها لثغور نظمت نظم الليالي لثغور
Amr Taufik here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR, low power FM, community and college radio stations, as well as on TV, public access and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org, where you can get our transcripts as well. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to mark the start of the fourth year of the war in Iraq, we turn now to Kevin Phillips, the former top Republican strategist. A generation ago, Kevin Phillips wrote The Emerging Republican Majority, which Newsweek described as the political Bible of the Nixon administration. Throughout the 1970s and 80s, Kevin Phillips was viewed as one of the GOP's top theoreticians and electoral analysts, but no more. Kevin Phillips is now warning that the party and the country as a whole is headed for potential disaster. He sums up his concerns in the title of his new book, American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. A review in Sunday's New York Times says the book may be, quote, the most alarming analysis of where we are and where we may be going to have appeared in many years. The book examines issues ranging from peak oil to the rapture to the future of the American empire. In a minute, we'll be joined by Kevin Phillips here in our Firehouse studio. But first, I want to turn to President Bush. On Monday, he spoke about the war in Iraq in Ohio. After his address, he took questions from the crowd. The first question addressed Phillips' book, American Theocracy.
My question is that author and former Nixon administration official Kevin Phillips, in his latest book, American Theocracy, discusses what has been called radical Christianity and its growing involvement into government and politics. He makes the point that members of your administration have reached out to prophetic Christians who see the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism as signs of the apocalypse. Do you believe this, that the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism are signs of the apocalypse? And if not, why not?
The answer is, I haven't really thought of it that way. Here's how I think of it. First, I've heard of that, by the way. I guess I'm more of a practical fella. I vowed after September the 11th that I would do everything I could to protect the American people. And my attitude, of course, was affected by the attacks. I knew we were at a war. I knew that the enemy obviously had to be sophisticated and lethal to fly hijacked airplanes into facilities that would be killing thousands of people, innocent people, doing nothing, just sitting there going to work.
That was President Bush addressing the Cleveland City Club in Ohio. Kevin Phillips, longtime Republican strategist, joins us now. His new book, American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Happy to be here.
Quite a way to launch a book. the President of the United States questioned about it in the first Q&A at this historic City Club in Cleveland.
It's really an appalling thing because in the course of the last couple of days as my book tour started, I've talked with a number of conservatives, people running conservative publications, old aides from the Republican campaigns back in the 60s and 70s, and everybody agrees, and some are even starting to say it semi-publicly, this man is a national embarrassment.
Conservatives?
Conservatives.
On what grounds?
Well, some just because they know him and don't think anybody with his lack of qualification should be president. Others that think that the country has a black eye. Others that think that conservatism is now being threatened as much as liberalism was in the late 1960s by the Johnson administration. This is just a convergence of the ineptitude of one man, of the complicity of a number of other senior people in the administration. I don't know their exact motives. And a horrible situation for the Pentagon, because the Pentagon realizes that the American soldiery in Iraq is being brutalized in a way that then casts disrespect on the American Army, that interferes with recruitment. I 2 years ago gave a talk near Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and already dozens of people from the military were saying that this was going to be a black eye, and it's worse than a black eye. And you really have to say, and I have to say that Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, if we had a parliamentary system, they would be there before the bar of the Congress having to defend this, and that's where they should be.
Kevin Phillips, you talk about radical religion, about debt, and about oil, about this being an oil war. You also talk about peak oil. That's not talked about very much in the mainstream. Explain.
The peak oil idea is that just as the United States oil production peaked in 1971, that we have a limited amount of oil globally and that it's something that can't be recreated, is running out. And the expectation of some is that the oil production of the non-OPEC countries will peak at some point during the 2010s and that then the production of OPEC itself will peak in the 2020s or 2030s. Now, some people think that Saudi production has already peaked. Now, if you believe this, and it's possible, then we face an enormous convergence, again, of specific oil-related circumstances, of a global struggle for natural resources as the price of oil climbs, as we turn the armed services into a global oil protection service, which has been happening, and as we see the administration refuse to grapple with the need to really curb oil consumption in the United States, which is mostly through transportation and especially motor vehicles. And I just have the sense, as many others on the conservative side do, this administration has no strategy to deal with these converging problems, be they foreign policy, military, oil, debt. They're like the three little monkeys on the old jade thing that one sees no evil, one speaks no evil, and one hears no evil. Do they know anything? You know, that's an open question.
We see in Washington an oligarchy. I mean, you have President Bush, who is a failed oil man himself, Cheney, head of the former head of the largest oil services corporation in the world, Halliburton. Condoleezza Rice was on the board of Chevron for more than a decade. And you can go on from there. But what is the significance of this for this country and the world?
Well, what I'd like to do is broaden that, because you're absolutely right, and the Republicans are the principal vehicle of this. But they're by no means the only vehicle. When Lloyd Bentsen was the vice presidential nominee for the Democrats, he was somebody very closely connected to the oil industry. It turns out that Al Gore's father was closely connected to the oil industry, and he continued the relationship with Armand Hammer of Occidental. And as a result, David Ignatius of the Washington Post wrote a big piece back several years ago saying we really had almost everybody in the 2000 election was oil connected. It wasn't just the two Republicans, it was Al Gore too. It is such a power center in the United States, especially now that the South and the Sun Belt have become most important because that's where the bulk of the oil is, that they're into both parties, enormously powerful in Congress. There's an oil and petroleum culture in the United States that extends back 150, 200 years into probably half of our states. This is no criminal conspiracy or anything. This is just a major resource having evolved as something that's part and parcel of the American economy and American supremacy, and you can't just wish it away. It's a vested interest of the First Order.
The war in Iraq was over oil?
I think it was principally over oil. And let me qualify that by saying I think a certain amount of the reason for the war in Iraq was a larger geostrategic situation in which we were going to have to leave Saudi Arabia. And the way to develop an alternative oil supply and base was to aim at Iraq. Now, that went beyond purely oil as a consideration. Another facet of the invasion of Iraq, in 2002, George W. Bush gave a speech in Texas in which he talked about how Saddam Hussein had tried to assassinate his father. So there you have sort of the family aspect. And lastly, the Middle East is a battleground of biblical Armageddon and everything, and that's swimming into play. A number of the religious right people talked about Saddam Hussein as the Antichrist, and the Left Behind series, which is the Tim LaHaye 60 million sold context of the end times and Armageddon. Well, the Antichrist comes from New Babylon in Iraq, and the attempt was to portray Baghdad, Babylon, as the focal point of the end times. So that a whole lot of supporters of the administration, they didn't care about weapons of mass destruction. This was part of the unfolding biblical epic of the end times and the war between good and evil. And this is some of what I get into in the book. It's hard to explain it just in a short conversation.
Well, we've got some time.
Well, this is very central to the whole Republican constituency. What you've got is that 45% of American Christians believe in Armageddon. And the more religious ones, the fundamentalists and evangelicals, more than anybody else. So my assumption is that the Bush electorate is probably 50 to 55% people who believe in Armageddon and probably more or less the same numbers who believe that the Antichrist is already on Earth. And when you have this backdrop and you have a president who got his start in national politics as his father's liaison with a religious right back in 1987 and 88, you just have an enormous exposure to this whole psychological context and an awareness on the part of people in the White House that this huge constituency interprets the Middle East in this very unusual way.
I mean, let's go back to Reagan's time. And, of course, Reagan's vice president was George Bush Sr. He also embraced evangelicals. For example, I mean, in Central America, Rios Montt and Guatemala. What's the difference now?
Well, there's an enormous difference because Ronald Reagan was in many ways an easygoing guy. He could make a reference to Armageddon. He could pursue a right-wing type of politics like you're describing. But personally, he wasn't all that intense, shall we say. I mean, here was a man who was the first divorced president in American history, married to two different Hollywood actresses. He was not the incarnation of a religious right political outlook. Bush is.
And yet the right embraced him.
The right embraced him because that was at a point in time, and here I go back more to my Republican antecedents, where in my opinion during the 1960s and 1970s, the left had pushed much too hard against religion in an attempt to create a more secular society. And this just grossly misunderstood the role that religion plays in the United States, and it created this huge backlash. So the balance was beginning to be restored in the 1980s, and now the pendulum has swung. So the abuse is on the part of the religious right, the people who are complaining about being abused 30 or 40 years ago.
So explain where George Bush fits into this picture, George W. Bush,
you know,
religion, how he embraces the right, the religious right.
Let me pretend that we're talking about painting and French Impressionism, and I'm going to give you four or five Impressionist scenes. We can't do this very academically. Back in 1999 and 2000, as George W. was preparing to run, it's been reported or acknowledged that he told three or four different groups of preachers, conservative organizations, that he felt that God had called him to run for president. Well, he gets in the White House, and he's not doing terribly well, but 9/11 comes along, and this is a massive revitalization of his politics in the sense of a chance to create a conflict between good and evil and, in essence, rally his flock. And at that point in time, Dana Milbank of the Washington Post reported he did a survey of religious right leaders, and they agreed that God had chosen Bush for this moment. And he concluded the piece for the Post by saying that this was the first time in history that the leader of the religious right nationally was the president of the United States. And I believe that's how they felt. And then we go more Impressionist paintings on the wall here. We go to reports from the Middle East. This came in several Israeli newspapers and others. That Bush at one point commented, although the White House denies it, that he said God told him to invade Afghanistan, God told him to invade Iraq. And then we get 2004, and when he was campaigning in several places, again he played the religious card, and the Lancaster New Era in Pennsylvania, the old order Amish country, reported that Bush talked to a group of Amish, the plain people, and he said that he trusted that God spoke through him, and if that weren't true, he wouldn't be able to do his job. Now, they reported this conversation, but their reporter had not been there, so he couldn't substantiate it. But this thread, and I come back to my Impressionism, from a whole lot of people, many of them Republicans and people acquainted with the Republican Party, this has been in there. It's this sense that he is the prophet, and he is telling us what God wants. And this, to me, is an enormously important backdrop to this mess in what is, after all, the Bible lands for Christians, the Middle East.
We're talking to Kevin Phillips, a former Republican strategist. His latest book is called American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. We'll be back with him in a minute.
Christian cannons have fired at my days with a warning beneath the holy blaze and bow to our authority, say the cannons of Christianity. Oh, the children will be sent to schools. Minds of clay are molded to the rules. Learn to fear all of eternity. Warn the cannons of Christianity. Holy hands will count the money raised. Like a king, the Lord is richly praised on a cross.
Phil Oakes singing Canons of Christianity. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guest is Kevin Phillips, former Republican strategist. His new book is American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Phil Oakes was saying that when you were very much on the other side.
Yeah, I was anti-establishment radical Republican. It's interesting how the insurgent politics divided, and now you have such ironies as, I can't mention the publications, but where you have conservatives talking about writing things for the nation and so forth because the old lines aren't central anymore.
You dedicate this book, Kevin Phillips, to the millions of Republicans present and lapsed who've opposed the Bush dynasty and the disenlightenment in the 2000 and 2004 elections.
Absolutely, and it's a considerable number. I was always cheered to see people I knew in crowds in different cities and people who own publications that you would think of as conservative Republicans, but they loved the book, so they wanted it reviewed and things like that.
Talk about debt. talk about the money aspect of American theocracy.
Well, this is a frightening thing because it's linked to religion, is there in a small way, which I'll come back to, but its principal origin, obviously, is economic. As the United States entered the 70s with inflation rising and oil prices skyrocketing in the Vietnam mess, budget deficits were rising, money was being borrowed. We no longer supported the dollar by buying or allowing foreign central banks to buy gold in Washington. So what happened is debt started to skyrocket. And as debt skyrocketed in the public sense, the budget deficit, we were having growing debt in the United States with mortgage, credit card, which was just starting in the 60s, public and private debt in every dimension, corporations, finance. By the 80s, this was going ballistic in all of the huge deficits under Ronald Reagan. The so-called current account deficit, which was the international credit balances affecting the United States, how much we net borrow each year, has skyrocketed. It's now closing in on more than 7% of GDP. This is borrowed prosperity. I think it's somewhat ineffective for the left to say that money isn't being sloshed around in the American economy. It is. But not only is it going to people at the top, it's going to people who have ties to the financial sector, mostly by owning financial assets, but also because the financial sector in the course of the last three or four decades has replaced manufacturing as the pivot of the American economy. The financial services sector now represents 21% of gross domestic product, and manufacturing is down to 14%. Now, because we don't make very much anymore, we have to import all kinds of things. Because we don't have too much oil anymore, relatively speaking, more than half of our oil has to come from overseas. This creates a massive current account deficit. Each year, it forces us to borrow. We become at the risk of foreign creditors, and this from the party that supposedly stands for fiscal responsibility. Now, neither of the parties stand for fiscal responsibility, but for the Republicans, it's the most outrageous transformation.
You quote the Times talking about the borrower industrial complex.
It really is, and the example I like to use is the rise of the credit card industry, which is now really a major industry. And in the course of the 90s and the first couple of years in this decade, they succeeded in getting legislation and decisions from the federal courts, basically, that allowed them to charge any interest rate and charge any fee. And as a result now, somebody whose perceived credit risk seems to change can all of a sudden wind up paying 28% interest on credit cards. The credit cards charge you fees for everything you can imagine. The low-income people get victimized the most. It's a giant industry in the United States. After Enron went under, MBNA, which was a big credit card company, took its place as George W. Bush's number one political patron in terms of contributions. So it's rotten. It's rotten. This is out of control. We are a money culture now.
If China, Japan called in the debt, what would happen?
Well, they can't call in the debt, but what would have to happen would be they would sell their U.S. securities, basically, treasuries, and so would some of the semi-public institutions in China, companies that are really government companies and so forth. You'd have a massive crisis in the global financial markets. The assumption is they can't do it because they would lose so much of the value of what they hold, but they could do it slowly, and they could shift to the euro and possibly to the Japanese yen, a basket of currencies, to gold. There are all kinds of things they can do. And people who know a lot about this just sit and worry. When is something like this going to happen?
Alan Greenspan gave a surprisingly frank warning about the state of the country's finances. He said, the prospective increase in the budget deficit will place at risk future living standards of our country. Can you talk about this?
Oh, they're already massively at risk, and they're already declining, and he knows it. For the last 5 years, you haven't had a net after-inflation growth in real family income because of the slow growth pattern. The slow growth pattern in the country comes because so much of the money is going to people who don't need to buy certain things, and because there's so much debt that it clogs the responsiveness of the economy to stimulus. And he knows it's a total mess. Paul Volcker, his predecessor as Fed chairman, has basically said there's 75% chance of a financial crisis. Now, again, the major media don't like to discuss this, but I think they're beginning to verge on a readiness to discuss it. And if there's one thing you can be sure of, George Bush couldn't describe all this intelligently if you spent 48 hours briefing him.
You don't think he's smart?
No, he's got a certain smart sort of fraternity boy towel snapping would make a good second vice president of the First National Bank of Amarillo. But, you know, nothing particularly for heavy lifting.
We're talking to Kevin Phillips, former Republican strategist. His book is called American Theocracy. Sandra Day O'Connor, Supreme Court Justice, former Supreme Court Justice, gave a speech. It wasn't recorded. It was in Washington, D.C. Of course, Sandra Day O'Connor, the reports were she was praying for George Bush victory and helped hand it to him the last time so that she could retire, so that he would be the one to choose her replacement. And she is the person who earlier this month warned the U.S. is in danger of edging towards a dictatorship of right-wingers that continue to attack the judiciary. What do you make of this?
Absolutely true. Tom DeLay, before he was pushed out, but Bill Frist as well, and some of them have gone to conferences about how they can reshape the judiciary and who they can push through and so forth. She's obviously very concerned. There are just endless numbers of Republicans that are privately very concerned. And I really don't know what's going to happen here, but if I can make bold with your microphone for a minute, there should be some thought among everybody in the United States, progressives, conservatives, serious, centrists, whatever you want to say, about how, if it becomes clear that this man really cannot function as president, we can deal with that situation. I don't happen to believe impeachment is the answer. This has become so sort of trivialized after Clinton and Nixon and the I'm going to get you because you got us sort of stuff. I think we have to think far beyond that.
What?
We need some kind of coalition government. Now, before I get in too much trouble for this, let me go back to Britain between the wars, World War I and II, when they were really on the skids. The old parties lost their validity. They were fragmenting. There were small parties, third parties coming up. So they frequently governed by coalition governments. They had one at the end of World War I. They had another for quite a while during the 1930s. I don't know exactly how we do this, but you have to dismantle this I'm going to get you because you got us impeachment business, and the way in which they're always zapping each other and they polarize, and the people in the middle represent only 15% because they're stalwarts in both parties from safe districts. Now, it's not that they're all that unreasonable personally, but when they're arraigned against each other politically, it doesn't work too well. So I think we're going to face within a few years a further realization of how ineffective our institutions have become.
In 1982, you wrote a book entitled Post-Conservative American, and you warned against the country drifting toward what you described an apple pie authoritarianism.
Well, the source of this in terms of a concept of where it would come from was the Sun Belt, which was a term I coined in the emerging Republican majority. And it's exactly the sort of politics that would lend itself to a politics of patriotic militarism and support the troops and don't worry about the dissidents, and we're going to have flag-waving mega churches in every suburb from Anaheim to Houston to whatever. This is the part of the country that would generate from. And I think that's some of what George W. Bush has tried to put together. But I think the antidote to that at this point is the extent to which huge percentages of the old Republican coalition that gave Richard Nixon 61% in 1972 and Ronald Reagan 59% in 1984 are not going to play ball with this. Not at all.
I just wanted to correct the quote I attributed to Alan Greenspan. It's actually his successor, the man who replaced him, Ben Bernanke, who said the prospective increase in the budget deficit will place at risk future standards of our country, the living standards of our country. But I wanted to ask you about the Dixie Cup, as you refer to, talking about the United States in a Dixie Cup, the new religious and political battlegrounds.
Well, what's happened is really that the southern shift to the Republican Party, which was starting even during the New Deal as a kind of upper bracket economic shift, and then in the Dixiecrat movement in 1952 became both racial and upper bracket economic, and then with Wallace and the effect of that insurgency shifted much more of the lower middle class and blue collar vote. Slowly but surely, the South became the mainstay of the Republican coalition. And you would have to say that was the case by 1984, when Reagan swept every southern state, and it was going down below the presidential level. By the end of the 80s, even George H.W. Bush, not a strong candidate, but a weak one in 1992, he did very well in the South. It had clearly become the Republican stronghold. Well, the rise of the religious right and the southernization of the Republican Party has created a role of religion within the Republican Party that is unprecedented in the 20th or 21st century. And this has become a central fact, the extent to which rank-and-file Republicans have a somewhat theocratic view of what government should do and how it should ally with religion, and the extent to which the Republican Party has become the favored party of the most religious conservative segments of Protestantism, Catholicism, and Judaism, wherein you have the Orthodox Jews in the United States turned out in such number, and they're growing anyway because of large families, that that pushed up Bush's share of the Jewish vote. So it's the fire eaters on the religious side, whether it's some nut who's the head of a mega church outside of San Antonio who's talking about Armageddon, or Catholics who are connected to the sort of, I don't want to say secret cabal wing that used to be associated with Rome, and some of the Jewish elements, some of whom have gone back from the United States to Israel so they can cause their trouble right on the front line.
And where does Israel fit into this picture?
Well, I don't want to carry water for AIPAC or any of the lobbies, because I know they go too far. But I would say Israel fits into this picture because of its biblical role. It's about as simple as that. If you just had Jews taking up the cudgels for Israel, it wouldn't do it. What you've had from the start is that the country in Europe that was most anxious to have an Israel in the 19th century was Britain. Because that's where you have, well, Disraeli was prime minister, but you had a fair Jewish community. And there was this Protestant sense of, to have the biblical prophecies come true, Israel had to be restored. And in the United States, the expectations among Christian evangelicals that foreign policy should serve a biblical aspect, in other words, that this should become part of American foreign policy, it's huge. I don't know the size of the American Protestant population that's caught up in the future of Israel, but it's so huge that somebody like Tom DeLay wouldn't refer to portions of Israel by their current name. He'd go back to the Bible.
You start your book, Fuel and National Power, and you talk about the history of Western fuelishness, where you quote Henry Kissinger, control energy, and you control the nations. And you quote Secretary of Energy Spencer Abraham in 2002. You and your predecessors in the oil and gas industry played a large part in making the 20th century the American century. Do you think that the what you describe, the American empire, is headed for doom?
It's certainly headed for some degree of dismantling and loss of international power. Now, to say it's headed for doom, even when Britain lost its place in the world, it wasn't headed for doom, and it reconstituted itself. A lot of people are happy and fairly prosperous in the UK right now. But we can't go on in the imperial mode, in which we just demand the world's natural resources and that the dollar be the vehicle for everything and that we be able to invade wherever we want. I don't think that'll last more than another 10 years. I think the crisis builds up sufficiently in the 2010s that the United States is really going to have to consider what resources it has in terms of energy, what resources it has in terms of the economy, how far it can push its military, a whole set of issues.
Kevin Phillips, thank you for joining us.
Thank
Kevin
you.
Phillips' book is called American Theocracy, and that does it for our broadcast. You can get the transcript, you can see or hear the broadcast at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shrivo Dokadoos, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Special thanks to Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, and as well, Megan Whitney. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.